I'm Ray Guess. I'm an alcoholic. Bo said he would come up and adjust the mic, and I told him that was okay. I brought a big book to stand on. Y'all got that, didn't you? Dirk, thank you for asking me up here. Adina, thank you for speaking yesterday. And Scott, it's hard to follow such speakers. But anyway, my story is my story. And my sponsor always says, don't laugh at me. It makes me worse. My drunk-a-log kind of reminds me of a guy named Bob who on Fridays afternoon he got paid. And on his way home, he thought about it. Well, he'd just stop and have a few drinks with his fellows at the local watering hole, and he'd stop. And usually he wouldn't show up till Sunday afternoon. And by then, the wife was pretty angry. There'd be a lot of hollering and cussing, and she'd a tirade going on. And finally, after a couple hours, she asked Bob, said, Bob, what would you think if you didn't see me for 2 or 3 days? And Bob thought a minute, and he said, that'll be all right. Well, Monday came, and Bob didn't see her. And Tuesday and Wednesday, the same, he didn't see her. Then on Thursday morning, the swelling had gone down a little bit in his left eye, and he could see it, barely see. Being a drunk doesn't have to be gloom and doom. I'll do a little bit of drunk log, and I'll try to get into recovery. And I was thinking about this when Dirk asked me, and I've got some things I'd really like to say or bring up. It's kind of important to me. But anyways, to start with, a little bit about, I was born and raised in Chattanooga, so not far from here. And I was one of four children. I've got an identical twin brother, and I was telling the other folks we're identical, and he's a good-looking guy. We were mirror twins. And in high school, and first year and freshman in college, we'd swap dates or swap classes all the time. I'd study for one, he'd study for the other or whatever. But he stole a girlfriend from me one time, and I thought that was devastated, but I find that worked out better anyway for the long haul. But anyways, let me get on into the story. I married my high school sweetheart. Then I became very serious about life. And what I thought life was material things. And so it's kind of like that movie, The Jerk, when he started out of the room, I'll be happy if I just had this, and started out the room if I just had that. And before he got out the door, he had a whole handful of lamps and everything. So what I would tell you is I'd be happy if I had a lamp. But I found that I worked extremely hard and was gone working all the time. And my wife, I've got a grown son and a daughter and 3 grandchildren, but we didn't have the grandchildren then, of course. But and I can recall about 1980. The wife and I we'd built a new house on the lake and had 2 new cars and 3 boats, and life was, you know, that's material things, and life was supposed to be good. But so we take on one Saturday morning, take a little son, 8 years old, down to this basketball game. And while he was playing, I looked over at my wife and I asked her, I said, what do you think about getting a divorce? And she said, you know, that sounds like a good idea. And that's kind of normal, isn't it? But it went downhill from there. It was pretty good for a couple of weeks. I was a junior partner in a manufacturing company there in Chattanooga, and one day I was out in the plant, the secretary came and said, Ray, your wife just left and your clothes are in the parking lot. And they were literally in the parking lot. So anyways, that wasn't a big deal. So I got the clothes, put them in the car, and moved up the hill to a place right next to a watering hole. So at that time, drinking was a little bit important to me. I didn't really have a drinking problem because if you worked as hard as I do or did, you deserved a few drinks. You know, that you'd hear that a lot, and that was my thing. You know, I deserve a couple of drinks. And so I'd have a couple of drinks. And those couple of drinks would last, you know, to 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning, and I'd go to bed and get up at 6 or 7 and go to work or whatever. I'd never even heard of Alcoholics Anonymous at that time. But anyways, this friend of mine who went to high school together, and he graduated, and he was a pharmacist. And he came by one day, and he said, Ray, he said, you don't look very good. And I looked at him, I said, Boyd, I never thought you looked good either. And he said, no, I'm not talking about uglier. I'm talking about look like you hadn't got much sleep. And I said, I really hadn't. I've been worrying. But the truth was, I wasn't worrying. I was drunk. But anyways, he said, I'll bring you something to help you sleep. I thought, well, I don't have a problem sleeping. You just got to get there where you want to sleep. But anyways, he brought me some pills. He said, it'll make you not as nervous. So the wife called one day and wanted to have a business meeting about economics. And I thought, well, that's a good thing. So I set up this meeting at 4 o'clock over at this kind of a high, what I call a high-class watering hole, where you could have a few drinks, you know, and, you know, gracefully talk about business, you know. And I thought about it about noon. I thought, you know, I better take one of them little pills. That'll calm me down. And these were little blue pills. So I took one, you know, and it didn't do anything. So by 4 o'clock, I'd taken 4 of them. And they still hadn't done anything because I got to the meeting place, and the way I drank, you always had to order a double to start with because, you know, how slow they bring drinks. And that first one goes down like water or Kool-Aid, and you order a double, you down it, and you get another one coming. But what I recall after that, a short period of time, there was some kind of big ruckus going on in this building. The wife left, and there was a big, and I got kicked out of there. And it was about 15 miles up the interstate and 5 miles up a country road to where we lived. So I was driving this big Bronco, so I get in it. And the thought occurred to me, she just didn't understand. I'll drive up there and explain it to her. So I got in the car, and I drove up there. I went in, and there was this tirade. She was raging and carrying on, and she kind of ran me out, and I got in the car. And the thought occurred to me, she's really ticked me off. So I was driving four-wheel drive, so I put it in low gear and drove through the house. And drove through the hallway into the bedroom. Then I thought, you know, that didn't make me feel any better. You know, when you take a drink, you get that feeling of ease and comfort. Well, driving through the house, you don't get that feeling. Now, maybe some of you do, and maybe some of you don't, but you got to try it to prove it. Anyway, so I backed out, and I got in the... decided I better leave. And so I drove back down the... and it was before, you know, cell phones ran, so... I drove down there to a Quick Market and decided I needed a little relief, so I bought a six-pack and sat there for a few minutes and collected my thoughts. Then I thought, I'll call back up there. I can talk my way out of this. And I don't know how long I'd been there, but I called back up there, and what I noticed was the brother-in-law was there, and he lives way off somewhere else, so I don't know how much time had passed, but I told him just to... he wasn't one of my favorite people, but I told him if he'd wait right there, I'd be back up there and we'd square it away. So I got back in the car and was driving back up there, and it was, I guess it's getting pretty late, but right before I get to where my home was, there was a kind of a narrow road that kind of narrowed down to almost one lane, and there was my father. Car parked, and he was doing this. You know, where he came from, I don't know. Anyway, I got out of the car, and Dad said, Ray, you're in the wrong place tonight. And about that time, we heard this scream, and the brother-in-law hit me in the back, and the next thing was, no, it was in about a 4-foot ditch. He was on top of me, but I was getting a few good licks in. when the blue light showed up. And they said, get your ass out of that ditch. And I said, all right. So I got out of the ditch, and they put me up against the car and put the handcuffs on. And I keep asking, why are you handcuffing me? He started the fight. He said, it's not about the fight. It's driving your car through the house. I said, I didn't drive my car through the house. I was doing some remodeling. And they didn't really go for that. So they take you to jail. So I go to jail. But that's how my alcoholic life really started, you know, from knowing that what life was about was material things. So I got the material things, and what I found was I didn't have enough of them. That was my problem. So when I got out of jail, I found out that my job had, I'd been kind of bought out from my company. I said, that's no big deal. That wasn't enough money anyway. I needed more lamps. So I contacted a few people and scraped up quite a bit of sum of monies, then contacted two or three states to see what they would offer if I built this big facility in their state. Well, guess what? Alabama was dumb enough to do it. So I get this place up north Alabama, and while I was there, I needed another CNC programmer, and I was down here in Birmingham one day, and I was looking around for somebody to do that job, and the customer of mine recommended a person, and he said, it's a she, and he gave me her name, and I called her, and she came up and interviewed, and she took the job. And that person is sitting right there, Regina, tonight, but I didn't realize at that time she had a drinking problem. I didn't know that. Now, I could drink, and, you know, and she, you know, it was all right, but I didn't know she had a drinking problem. So anyways, we stay in touch. It took me a year to take all that money and build this big company. I was going to make all these lamps and go busted. So a year from there, even the bank called and said, you still driving that car? And he said, yeah. I said, it's ours. Bring it back. And I said, well, I won't have anything to drive. They said, we're not concerned about you. And I thought, well, that's going to affect how I look. And that's also going to affect how I get drinks, because it's kind of hard to walk to the watering hole and go in and have a few drinks and come out and walk home, wherever home I'd be at that time. And I'd already, you know, naturally gone through a divorce. It wasn't my fault at all. But anyways, I decided that a geographic cure would be in order. So I moved to Birmingham in 1990. And Regina, I'll mention her name, asked me to help her to do some sales and some things, and I kept putting that off. She had gone over to Mississippi to work for Hughes Aircraft or something like that. And I helped the guy with some sales stuff for a little while, but anyways, I finally said, okay, after a couple of years, I'll help you do something. And what I found after doing that for about a month or two, we ended up starting a new company and became business partners. And at that time, that would have been about 1993. In 93, I don't think she had a drinking problem. But by 1998, she had a serious drinking problem. Because I'd rented me an apartment, and I'd go in, I'd sit down, and I would have me a couple of drinks before I went to the watering hole to have a few drinks. And she come busting in on me and said, what are you doing? What is that you're drinking? And I thought, she must want what I've got. She don't have enough of it to get her own, I guess. But finally she said, you know, the real problem is we can't communicate. So what we need is a person to help us communicate. So she found this guy, an industrial psychologist. He was an electrical engineer first, then he became an industrial psychologist. So he then I knew I was getting ganged up on when I had to meet with them, you know, and had two or three different kind of meetings that was together, that was me, her, and him. Then there were her and him, and then there was me and him. And it always started out real casual, like, well, how are things going? Are you doing all right? Well, those are dumbass questions. What do you think I'm here for? You know? But then it'd say, you think you drink too much? No. Well, how much do you drink? I say, the normal is a couple of drinks. That's what we do. I have a couple of drinks occasionally. Occasionally, you know. And he'd say, well, if you don't drink much, why don't you quit? So I asked him, I said, do you drink? He said, I like to have a glass of wine with spaghetti sometimes. And I say, why don't you quit? make your life as miserable as you're trying to make mine. And he was very gracious about that. And he said, well, I'll tell you what, if you're not an alcoholic, you could probably not drink for 30 days. I said, sure, I cannot drink for 30 days. So I thought, I'm going to do this to get these people off my case. It's kind of like getting a fly in your car and you can't get rid of it while you're driving down the road. So I made this deal with that guy. So 30 days later, I remember I was back in his office and he said, well, how's it going? I said, fine. He said, have you had a drink? I said, not for 30 days. He says, what are you going to do now? I said, I'm going to go have some drinks. My 30 days are up. Well, that wasn't the right thing to say. I could see that coming. And so what happened next, by the way, I told Bo I wouldn't talk over 77 minutes because he said that's all that they could record. And I said, well, why don't we take a break after 77? We'll do another 77. And he said, it sounded to me like the first 77 was BS. No, he said the last 77 was BS. I said, no, the first 77 is going to be BS. So y'all are getting the first 77. Where was I? And after that, they came up with this idea that I needed to go to a rehab. And I'd never heard of one of those things. And I said, I didn't have a day to spare to go to one. And they said, oh, no, they're not days, they're weeks or months. And I said, as important as I am, you think I could be gone that long? You know, or I'm going to be gone that long? So after a couple of weeks of back and forth, they found a place that was only, at that time, 10 days downtown Birmingham called UAB, University of Alabama, Birmingham. And it was a 10-day deal. So I thought, well, I'll make that sacrifice to appease them and go down there for 30 days or 10 days and get this behind me. Then I can go back to my life. So the day finally came, I packed my stuff and I went down there. And what happened, I went in the first lane and they said, did you bring any money? And I said, for what? Are we going to do some gambling today or what? And they said, to pay for this. And I said, oh, no, I didn't bring any money. I'm not in charge of this. And, well, wait a minute. And it seemed like right after that, the money showed up. And then so I had this bag and went upstairs. And this really was disturbing. The guy showed me to this room, and I set this bag down. I had my clothes in. And I looked over there, and he was opening my bag and going through it. And I looked around him, I said, you know, I was brought up better than that. Especially with somebody, my own bag, and you're going through it, me standing there and you looking at me watching you. At least I have the decency to wait till I'd gone away. But anyways, that was the start. So then he directed me to this room and they was having a meeting, and I went through this meeting and they went downstairs to lunch and went back upstairs and they had this discussion meeting and was going around the room. And they got to me and said, do you have anything to share? And I said, no, I just got here. And that's what I said, and I said, okay, and they passed. After the meeting, the guy was heading the thing up. He said, I need to see you in his office. So I went back there, and he said, we don't like your attitude. And I said, I don't like your attitude either. And he said, well, why don't you just leave? And I said, that's a great idea. So I knew that was a bad place, so I got my stuff and left. And I called Dr. Bannon and told him what a piece of crap that place was and how rude they were and how they'd pilfered my clothes and then talked to me. So the next couple of weeks, I just had a few drinks and played golf and just stayed gone for a while. Then I could tell her drinking problem was going to get worse the way she communicated. So they finally told me I had to do something. And that fly was still in my car. So what I did, they said I had to make the call. Well, I knew I wasn't going to go back down to that place because those people kicked me out. And the next time we went in there, we'd probably be duking it out. So I didn't want, you know, to show them up. But so I didn't. So I figured, you know, I got a plan. And I'm telling you this, it's the first time I've mentioned this out. And it wasn't to be above anybody or anything. I was trying to come up with a way to get out of it. And I'd watched TV the day before, and I saw where Betty Ford had started his center out in Palm Springs. So I suggested, yeah, I'll go to the Betty Ford Center. And I thought, so yeah, really? And I said, yeah. But I knew if I called out there, or they did, they'd say, they said, you got to call. So I figured, I'll call out there and put my name on a list, and they'll forget about it in a few months, and I can go back to doing what I do. So I called out there, and it didn't work. They said, we're glad you called, blah, blah, blah. And they sent some stuff and asked for information about her. And obviously, she had the drinking problem because they talked to her, too. You know, and they all this plotting was going on behind, you know, it was behind the scenes. And I thought, well, so finally the day came that I had to go out there. And I could just see it flying out there and getting off at the airport, and there's got this big sign saying, Ray Guest for the drunk going to rehab. I could just see that. And I didn't want anybody to have that idea to think that I was a drunk. You know, I like to drink like the best of them, but I wasn't an alcoholic. I just liked to have a few drinks. So I got off the plane, and discreetly, some guy found me. And we got in this van and went over there. Then they put me in there and did some evaluation with this psychologist, and he asked me why I was there. And I told him my business partner had a drinking problem. And he said, well, what do you want to do while you're here? And I said, get out of here. And he said, do you know how long you're going to be here? And I said, are you fixing to kick me out? And he said, not yet. If you follow these rules, you can stay. I said, but I don't really want to stay. He said, well, normally, so we'll do an evaluation. And by the way, I'd really curtail my drinking just to prove to these people that I wasn't an alcoholic. And I didn't want to have to go through DTs or any of that other stuff. I was just a guy that liked to have a few drinks. And behind the scenes, I think Regina can tell her story, but I've heard her say some things. About the middle of being out there, she shows up. I said, now that's a big deal. But anyways, so I was there for 28 days. And what I found was everybody out that worked there, even the people that mowed the grass, anybody that did anything was involved in 12-step recovery. The cooks, the people that drove you to the airport, the doctors, the PhDs, everybody was recovering, everybody. There was not a person there that was working there that wasn't a drunk or an addict. And I had to go to 3 or 4 AA meetings a day, and they put me in this room. It had four rooms, like a dormitory, and there's about 20 guys. But when Mrs. Ford went there, when she went through rehab, I read her recovery, and she showed up, and they said, Mrs. Ford, we'll take you back to your room. And they took back, and there was a room that had another lady. And Mrs. Ford said, I can't accept this. I've got to have a private room. And so they told her, said, okay, we'll ask that lady to leave. And Mrs. Ford realized she didn't want to hurt somebody else. So there was one room in that dormitory that had three beds, and that they call it the swamp, and I was in that room. And the two other guys I was with, one of them was the director for photography for the president. The other one was a senator from Washington State. Then there was me. And they asked me why I was there. And I said, I'm here because my business partner had a drinking problem. Well, they got tired of hearing that crap. And I got tired of telling them. So after 28 days, I go back to Birmingham, and I get off the on the Sunday. I remember getting back, and I couldn't wait to get home. And Regina picks me up at the airport, and we go out, and I'm supposed to turn left to go to my house. She turns right, and it was Sunday afternoon. I said, where are we going? She said, to an AA meeting. And I said, well, I've been on an airplane ride for a few hours. I'd kind of like to go to my room. I call them where I stay in my room. She said, well, this won't hurt you. So we go down to Hoover, that's an area in Birmingham, and standing out front out there, I was smoking. You know, I think a newcomer must have "kick me" written on him, because the people come up and said, here's my phone number if you want somebody to talk to you. And I look around and said, I didn't say anything to them. What are they doing? Why do I look like I need somebody to talk to? I didn't understand that. I had planned, my plan for sobriety was I was going to have the best of both worlds, because what my plan was, I would go to a couple of those AA meetings a week, then I would go down to my watering hole and have a few drinks with my buddies a couple of nights a week, and life would be good. I'd have the best of both worlds. Well, the next day came, and I think I went to Mountain Brook to a meeting, because I didn't want anybody around. I lived over in Center Point at that time. I didn't want anybody over there to think I was an alcoholic or drunk, so I was going to other areas 20, 30 miles away. And they, what's your name? My name's Ray Gift. You know, that kind of stuff. And when it get to me, time to share, I'd try to go to the meetings that were speaker meetings. That way I didn't have to be involved. You just listen. But then I thought, I noticed that Regina's drinking problem wasn't quite as serious, so she wasn't on my case quite as bad. Her attitude was a little better. Not totally. I don't want to get her thinking she's too good. But a couple of weeks went by, and I hadn't had a drink. Of course, I didn't drink while I was out there. So I had, you know, almost a couple of months not drinking. And I thought, vodka was my favorite drink, and you can't smell it, so, you know, who's going to know? You know, who's going to know? But anyways, so I showed my, by the way, my home group is Center Point in Birmingham, and my sobriety date is August the 28th, 1998. And I couldn't believe that I'd have 18 years of not drinking one day at a time. That's just beyond belief for me. But anyways, when I showed up at Center Point one night, and my plan was, if you time it just right, you can get to this meeting where you, any of them, and you go in, if you do a little research, you can find out where to get in and sit in the back, and as soon as it's over, you can get out without being confronted. You know, joining and signing up, and we're glad you're here and all that kind of stuff. Well, I screwed up. I got there about 15 minutes early, and not all of them had gone in, and this guy's standing out there by the smoking pot, and I thought, well, I'll get away with it. I went over there, and he said, have you got a light? And I said, yeah. I did that, and he said, I used to shake that way, but I've been a member of Alcoholics Anonymous for about 6 months. I said, okay. I said, you still want a light? Yeah. So then we went on inside. Well, that particular guy became one of my best friends. My best friend. He passed away a couple years ago from cancer. He was one heck of a guy. He and another guy, a friend of mine who's on the steering committee there in Birmingham, it's kind of like the Stadler brothers. I call us the class of 98. You know, I could just see a football jacket with 98 written on the side of it. You know, we're the class of 98. But anyway, going to that center, the reason I mentioned that, by the way, the cost of that, this is another issue. I had to personally pay for that. And the cost of that, by the way, wasn't any much more than going to Bradford here in Birmingham. So it wasn't like I was going to... Now, if you go to one of those non-alcoholic things, you can pay anywhere from $60,000 to $100,000. But where I went was, only, at that time, 98 was like $20,000 for 28 days. And I had to pay for that. And that ticked me off. So that's another reason for not drinking, because if I drank, I'd be throwing $20,000 down the tube. And that's a big reason not to drink. I'd be kind of stupid to throw... That's just like taking a $20,000 bill and burning it. And who wants to do that? I never told Gina that. But anyways, that center out there, they called and said, we'd like for you to come back. I said, oh, I don't want to go back there. I've been there. They said, no, to be a RAV. That's a regional area volunteer. And I said, what is that about? And so Regina and I, we flew back out. And we talked to them, and they wanted us to start a group in Birmingham for anybody in Alabama that went to that center that would contact us before they came back home, and we'd find them a group to go to and help get them started in recovery. And so we started doing that. So we'd fly out there, and we would meet with Mrs. Ford with 50 other people, and we'd go around the room, and we'd have to tell Mrs. Ford what we were doing in Birmingham to help these drunks here in Birmingham not drink one day at a time. So that helped me in not drinking, you know. Mrs. Ford autographed a book, a biography, and gave it to me one day. And I was going around the room one day, and she came to me, and that was after that Forrest Gump movie, and he said, what's going on in your area? And I said, Mrs. Ford, it's kind of like Alabama's kind of like a box of chocolate. And they didn't laugh. I thought, but I screwed up. But we were at a dinner one evening. They had a big dinner on every year, anniversary, and they'd have like 1,000 people show up. And they'd be in this big ballroom, and everybody'd eat at the same time. They'd serve everybody at the same time. And Regina got up and go to the potty, and as she was going out, Mr. Ford and Mrs. Ford were walking through. So Regina got eyeball to eyeball with both of them, and she was going out, and I was looking at that, and I thought, wow, look at this. Only being an alcoholic could see something like that. Now, and I'm not telling you all this to say I'm important. I'm just telling you what happened to me, being a drunk, and how that helped affect my life. And it helped me help me not drink one day at a time. And so Regina and I did that for about, 10 years, Regina? Something like that. The group, till finally they just, nobody showed, so we finally quit doing that. But, so then I got active in my home group. The thing that kept me sober, first off, was the fellowship. The people in the group. And I made a mistake. My buddy I met outside to give the cigarette light one day, he told me, he said, I got to get a sponsor. And I said, oh, darn, if he gets a sponsor, I'll have to get one of them things. So I went in that meeting that evening and sat in the back and did a group inventory. And picked a guy that I knew. The way he talked, I said, that guy's slow. That would be a good sponsor for me. So after the meeting, I went over and asked him. And he said, okay. And he asked me if I could be there at something like 5:30 the next day, and he'd show me how to make coffee. I thought, well, how difficult is pouring water in a damn coffee cup or in a coffee maker? But anyways, I did that. And I had all the chairs lined up. I mean, we had to set up and take it down after the meeting. And I had them, you know, just strung like a, you could take a string and pop it. It was that straight. And I was expecting an attaboy. He didn't give me one. No, that's a good job or nothing. I said, well, what do you think about that? He said, that's the way it's supposed to be. Okay. And that's how I got started in Alcoholics Anonymous. Then after keep going to the meetings one day at a time, the guy said, get in my truck, we're going to this meeting on Wednesday. Our, my home group met on Monday, Tuesdays, and Fridays. So on Wednesdays and Thursdays, we'd get in his truck, and we'd go places. And we'd do that every week, and we'd get four, five, six guys, and we'd go places. And so I got to meet Tom, Dick, and Harry, Hilda, Grant, and Gary, and Virginia Ruth as I traveled around the Birmingham area meeting all you folks one day at a time. Walt shows up over there one day. My home group, I was new, and they're just going to set up, and he's there early. I'm the first one there, and he's sitting out there in the parking lot. And I thought, who is this damn drunk pulled up? Because he gets out and says, is this where them A&A meetings are? And I didn't know he was cutting up with me. Yes, sir, it is, but I've got to set up, and the meeting doesn't start to 8 o'clock. Oh, okay. So I go in. I said, you just wait right here, and I'm going in and set. So he follows me in, and he keeps bugging me and wanting to set up. He's just playing me like a yo-yo, but he did a great job. But I don't know. It wasn't that particular night, I don't think. But sometime later on, him and a few other guys, we ended up eating dinner at the Cracker Barrel there in Trustful and sitting out there in those rocking chairs till 2 o'clock in the morning. You know, 2 o'clock in the morning, talking about recovery. Yeah, and thinking about that today, that just makes my heart good. My sponsor was big on service work, and at the time he was he was on the board of Mountaintop Roundup Board, and he asked me if I'd like to be a part of that, and so I told him I did. And so since 2000, I've been on the board of Mountaintop Roundup to help do what it is. And the late Mickey Hawkins asked me a few years back when John was talking about me in and out. Well, I did the same thing at Sumatonga. I'd show up, then I wouldn't show up. And I don't know why it was, but it's just the way I do things. Then Mickey called me one day, and she started rattling off all these qualifications. I'm looking for somebody that can do this and do that. And I said, obviously, you got the wrong number. And I was just cutting up with her, and she said that she asked me to be on the board of Sumatonga. And I told her that was an honor, and I would. And I did, and I still am. And it's been a real rewarding experience. What I've noticed about Mod Eagle Roundup, the specialty of this group, amazing to have people have an age group from sobriety of 54 years to 4 months. That's awesome. Can you imagine such a thing? That's just so heartwarming. And I've got to put a few bulk fillers in there to get my 77 minutes in. What do you think? I can't tell. I think he means wind it up, and I think that's a good idea. I don't like to over-talk. I just like to say it like it is, and it's been a real honor to be asked to speak. And I'm glad it's over. Thank you.